Damn right we're not done. This is the 6 ESPN 102.5 The Game. I'm Elijah Campbell here in an empty studio, a little lonelier here. I had Chase, I had Caroline, and the other side of the glass, and now one, which is the loneliest number you can ever do. I'm here in the studio by myself, but that's okay, because when you sit behind the board during a lot of these shows, your takes develop a little bit. They get some time to simmer. You have a little more time to think about them as you're preparing for the show that you're doing. And today, all of this Preds talk, all of this Jimbo versus Nick Saban, which I'm excited to get to, by the way, because if there's a chance to slander Nick Saban, I'm going to do it. Professional Nick Saban hater. I love his accomplishments as a coach. He's the greatest to ever do it. But if I'm praying for a coach's downfall, it's Nick Saban. So you're not going to want to miss that. That's coming up next. But I got to lead off with the Preds, right? That's been the biggest story in the last half this week here, was David Poile and John Hines addressing the media. And we've done a really good job of covering it at the station, especially with prefacing it with they were honest. And everyone can appreciate a little bit of honesty. Everybody can appreciate honest reflection on the year. And one thing that we were looking for was reflection on the year and some honest assessments on how this team is moving forward. Because if you ask the average Preds fan, I think they would all agree that making the playoffs is fun. When you do it 8 straight years, it's impressive, and you'd rather be in the playoffs than out of the playoffs. But you'd rather be winning in the playoffs and not going home in 4 games like we just did. And it was announced during that press conference that Coach John Hines, who has been into the playoffs twice, the official NHL or Stanley Cup playoffs, you can count the series against the Coyotes in the bubble. I do, because it is win or go home on the line, even though it's not like wasn't the official playoffs. It was like a play-in series. I will count it. The Elijah Campbell record book will count that as a playoff series, because you're playing for your season, for the life of your season. So we'll count it. So playoff / elimination series. John Hines is 0-3. So when you get swept in the first round this year, for the third straight time, you go out in the first round or out in the first series, there's a lot of speculation on what the future of the coaching position is going to be. Well, David Poile squashed all of that, because honestly, the night before the press conference, there was the announcement that Hines was going to be extended. But to be able to squash all doubts, David Poile, in the opening statement of the press conference, had this to say about the future of John Hines and the Nashville Predators coaching staff.
Switching gears, I am proud to announce that John Hines and the entire coaching staff have agreed to 2-year extensions. I believe John has done an excellent job for us, taking over as coach on January 7th, 2020, leading us into the postseason each of the 3 years he has been here, helping some of our veteran players play to their best years that they have ever had, while creating an environment where our younger players can grow and develop.
So they're committed. David Poile says that he is committed to John Hines, and he believes he's the right guy to turn it around, which, A, I hope so. If you're extending him, I would hope that you believe in your heart that he is the guy to turn this thing around. But the one part at the end, I'll play it again, the one part at the end is one of the reasons why he thinks Hines is the right man for the job, is the one interesting part for me.
Helping some of our veteran players play to their players to the best years that they have ever had, while creating an environment where our younger players can grow and develop.
Development. And there are two parts of that, right? There are two parts of player development that I'm going to at least address here. There's a player development's a complex thing, and I don't want to minimize it by saying there's only two parts of player development that matter. But one is the development of your core players. Now, the Preds have, whether they actually wanted to or not, committed a lot of this future to Matt Duchene and Ryan Johansson. When you sign guys to 8-year deals, you are committing long-term to those guys. And after they had some very underwhelming seasons, especially from Matt Duchene, where they're willing for Seattle to take him for nothing in the expansion draft, left him unprotected so they could get that contract off their hands. It was undesirable. And you could even make a case before the season started, it was one of the more undesirable contracts in the entire sport on a scale of 1 to Russell Westbrook and John Wall in terms of bad professional sports contracts. You could say it was pretty high on that scale. 6-7, 8 if you're feeling a little frisky or if you really let the 2021 season soak in. But he broke a franchise record, most goals in a season. That takes some development, right? Matt Duchene has even acknowledged that it took a while for him and some of the other players to kind of gel with John Hines. There was a feeling out period, and that feeling out period took a majority of the season last year, and then, of course, we know the rest of the story. The Preds got hot. They gave Carolina hell in the first round before finally succumbing to them in six games, and then this year, Matt Duchene has that 40-plus goal season that this franchise has never seen until they got two of them this year. But with Duchene, like, he's right. There is a player development aspect that John Hines has succeeded in. Matt Duchene scoring that many goals after being pretty much undesired by this franchise before the Seattle expansion draft. That's pretty significant. I think John Hines had a hand in it, not all of it. But if we're going to honestly assess how we are evaluating player development by these coaches, it's important to note that. So I mentioned that, and you might be thinking, okay, well, that's one player. Well, Philip Forsberg, too, had a career year. I know he played in a contract year. I know that the contract is up, and if he plays this year, then he can set himself up for the rest of his career. But I don't absolutely discredit players because of that, because you still got to go out and do it. Like, my biggest gripe when people say, oh, well, it was a contract year. And? Like, you still got to be able to go out and perform. Just because you want to perform better for a new contract doesn't mean you're going to be able to do it. How many guys are in contract years, have bad years, and then never play the same again or never make the amount of money they would have made if they did have a great year? A lot goes into that. And Philip Forsberg, for the most part of the season, stayed healthy, and then bam, 40-plus goal season. Had an incredible season, his best as a Nashville Predator. Roman Josi, he was already won a Norris Trophy, had his best season as a Nashville Predator, and had an offensive season for a defenseman that is rarely seen in this sport. Anytime you're mentioned with Paul Coffey, in any kind of mentioning of how your season went, that's pretty significant, especially if those are heights that you haven't reached before, and you were doing that with a different kind of coach. I'm not saying Hines is responsible for all of this, but it's something to consider, that when they're looking at his resume, that there is player development that they like that is positive. UC Saros has turned into an everyday goaltender. Now, whether or not the wear and tear at the end of the season was responsible for the kind of dip he took statistically, yet to be seen. I think seeing another season of how he is playing a full season and getting that kind of workload, we'll see how that goes. I'll leave that one up for interpretation. But it's the second part of that, the second part of player development, that I think is cause for concern, and it's going to be what makes or breaks John Hines' tenure as the Nashville Predators head coach. I just talked about the veterans. He's gotten a lot out of those veterans, which coming into the season is what we asked for, right? We wanted more out of Ryan Johansson or Matt Duchene. You wanted more out of Philip Forsberg. You wanted more from UC Saros, since he was going to be the full-time goaltender and have a workload that not many goalies in the NHL were going to have. But you also needed a lot more from your younger guys, because the younger guys could be, like, when you're in a quote-unquote competitive rebuild or a competitive retooling, whatever the hell you want to call it, because you can call it a lot of different things. But those are the guys that are going to be the future. I mean, Roman Josi's on the other side of 30. Matt Duchene's on the other side of 30. Philip Forsberg's getting close. So if you bring him back, because there's not a guarantee that you bring him back. I think it's likely, but it's not a guarantee. You bring him back, he is getting closer to 30, entering the prime of his career. But whenever those guys are out of the primes of their career, you're not going to get that type of production you got from them this season. You're going to need younger players like Phil Tomasino, Tanner Jeannot, Luke Cunnan, Elli Tolvanen, guys that you brought in that were going to be young centerpieces, that you wanted to be significant contributors on playoff teams, so that way they could be able to get playoff experience in meaningful hockey games without having to be the sole responsibility of a lot of this production. Some of the worst teams you see in the NHL, right? Like, you can talk about Arizona, insanely young, but insanely bad, because they don't have a lot of great veteran leadership. Buffalo, young, really, really bad. Not a lot of great veteran leadership. You can build young talent on teams and still be horrifically bad every year. And then when it comes time to making the playoffs, they are kind of what you see from Edmonton several years ago. They're not getting out of the first round either. And they have a hard time getting out of the first round because they're young and inexperienced. So maybe this year would help because you get those younger guys experience in meaningful hockey games and playoff games as well as meaningful regular season games. But that's where this team kind of fell south, or they kind of fell short, rather, in my opinion. In March and April, late March, early April, when you had some losses against some bad teams, when you dropped games to teams like Buffalo on the road, you needed more from a lot of those young guys. You're still getting good production from those veterans that I alluded to earlier, but there were younger guys who, whether it be hitting the rookie wall, which is completely understandable when you talk about some of these guys playing 82-game seasons for the first time in their career. I get that. However, part of coaching and developing young talent is getting those young guys to be able to perform when you have must-win games, when there are games on the line in which you have to win to avoid playing Colorado in the first round. If you're getting a lot from your veterans and not getting it from those young guys, you might be contradicting your competitive rebuild a little bit. On the other side, I'll get into more of this second part of player development, of where if these guys don't develop, it can make or break these next two years for John Hines and determine how much longer of him we will see in Nashville. You're listening to The Six. I'm Elijah Campbell. Listen to us on 102.5 The Game, 106.3, our streaming service, The Game Nashville app, all that and more. We're coming up with more on The Six, ESPN, 102.5 The Game. That's right. Here is something fun. It is The Six here on ESPN, 102.5 The Game. I'm Elijah Campbell, maneuvering you through this 6 o'clock hour. And we're talking Preds. We're talking about the big press conference that happened in town on Thursday, where there was some honesty, some reflection, and some talk about the future. So let's talk about the future. John Hines, who, him and his coaching staff, got an extension. They will be the coaches of the Nashville Predators this year and the season after. And one of the things that we alluded to in the last segment was David Poile feels confident that John Hines is the man to take them all the way through and to lead them past the first round of the playoffs because of player development. And one thing we mentioned in the last segment was he did a pretty good job with the veterans because you got career seasons out of Matt Duchene, Philip Forsberg, and Roman Josi. And UC Saros is blossoming into a really, really good goaltender, especially as he's a Vezina finalist. He's not going to win the Vezina, but he's a finalist for the Vezina. And like I've said multiple times in this hour before, it's not all John Hines. However, there is something to be said that once he finally was able to learn these things about those veteran players, that they do start to produce a little bit more. That's one of the biggest parts of the player-coach dynamic. But the other part of this is how is he going to develop the younger players? And the younger players that we'll be focusing on, Luke Cunnan, Ili Tolvanen, Phil Tomasino, Tanner Janot. That's who we'll focus on here. But here is John Hines during that press conference talking about breaking down the multiple quote-unquote seasons within the season and how youth might have factored into how the season ended.
The last part for me, I would say where we can do is I agree with David. I thought for the most part, you know, the season was successful for those reasons. I think when you look down the stretch, we talked with our guys quite a bit about, we really break it up into basically 20 game segments. So game 1 through 20, that's your training camp, your first 20 games, your identity. You know, you don't make the playoffs in the first 20, but you certainly can get knocked out if you don't have a good start. You know, in that part of the season, we were 11-8-1. Then we go the next 20, right, 21 through 40. Now that was our best segment. You know, that's where I thought the identity was there. Our guys were fresh. We were continuing to play. I thought our work ethic, our competitive level, our structure was really in place from training camp through the first 20. And then we really talked with our guys about, okay, now 40 through 60, it starts to change. The league gets a little bit harder. You know, it's harder on the body as you continue to move forward. You know, you go through all-star break to the trade deadline. That's another level. And the hardest part of the season is that 60 through 82. You know, that's where the from the trade deadline on, that's where you have the teams are really ramping up to go. And I think for our team, that's where we, you know, we didn't handle it as well as we needed to. Now, some of that is youth, not all of it. Some of it is guys, when you get to the exit meetings, a lot of these guys said it's the first 82-game schedule. And when they go through on that, it's a marathon. You know, you're changing time zones. You're playing back-to-backs in different cities. You're some of these guys have experienced different players. Like, take Alex Carrier, for example. He played some of the hardest minutes in the league. He was on our top pair with Ekholm against the other team's top lines. And his meaning was like, last year we played the same team seven times. I knew the tendencies of Braden Point and these guys. But now you come in and you meet teams for the first time. It's a challenge. So that is only going to make us better. I think the fact that our players, our younger guys, had to be able to go through that experience and really take some lessons out of that, they're going to be key factors for us moving forward. So for them to be able to have those experiences, and not all of them were good. But they're going to be better for that, and our team is going to be better for it.
So he mentions hitting that wall, game 60 to 82, where the games are now really meaningful, right? But then the traveling settles in. Like, I know, obviously, what they do is so physically demanding, and I even get tired, even producing the radio broadcast of these games, right, to be able to, I can throw myself into this here. Even it can be exhausting just doing that. I can't imagine what playing an 82-game season is like, especially if you've never done it before. I do understand that takes some getting used to, but that is where the coaching comes in. The youth on this team is a big part of where the direction of the franchise is going. There is no competitive rebuild or competitive retooling without development of young players and players that are going to be your centerpieces once Roman Josi's no longer in the prime of his career, once Philip Forsberg is either not here or not in the prime of his career, or once you don't get 40 goals from Matt Duchene. Like, what if the Preds didn't get 40 goals from Duchene and Forsberg this year? They would have relied on those younger players to have produced a lot just to even get into the playoffs. I know if ifs and ands or pots and pans, the world would be a kitchen. However, like, humor me for a moment. Would you have felt comfortable with Phil Tomasino, Tanner Janot, Ellie Tolvin, and Luke Cunnan creating a scoring output that would have helped recreate the output we saw from the Preds this year if Philip Forsberg and Matt Duchene both didn't have 40-plus goal seasons? I don't think so. And David Poile said in that press conference, too, if they each would have traded Philip Forsberg, if they didn't get a deal done with his contract, they wouldn't have made the playoffs. And he's damn right about that. They would not have made the playoffs. They needed all of those 40-plus goals from him, and they needed all those 40-plus goals from Matt Duchene, because here is what you got from those younger players in March and April. I know Hines specifically said game 60 through 82. That's 22 games, but I'm taking all of March and April. Luke Cunnan, in the last 29 games of the season, March and April, 2 goals, 1 assist, which equals to a grand total of 3 points. He was a minus 10 on the ice. Ellie Tolvanen, in the last 26 games of the season, March and April, 4 goals, 3 assists, grand total of 7 points. He was a minus 8 on the ice. Now, Phil Tomasino, there's a little bit of a bright spot here. This is where there's something to really work with Tomasino. I like him a lot. Last 29 games this season, 4 goals, 11 assists, 15 points, was a plus 7 on the ice. Phil Tomasino is a guy who, I think, if John Hines can have that kind of impact on some of these other players, you might see him longer because the Preds might be able to advance a little bit. And then there's Tanner Janot. Tanner Janot, red hot start to the season, 24 goals in total. But in the last 28 games, 6 goals, 3 assists, 9 points, was a minus 8 on the ice. That's March and April for Janot, right? Well, I took the numbers for just the month of April. I know there's some personal factors. He did have the birth of his first child during all this, which I am not a parent. Don't plan on being one anytime soon. But I know pretty damn well the amount of, or the lack of sleep you get during that process, and mixing that with traveling in the NHL and finishing an 82-game season for the first time in your career can be tough. But here's what his April looked like. Played 15 games, 1 goal, 0 assists, so 1 point in total, for a minus 7. You needed more out of Janot in those games to be able to avoid playing Colorado. Now, disclaimer, I think they would have lost to Calgary because Calgary's a machine and Calgary is my pick to win the Stanley Cup. I love that Flames team, and they got it going on. However, you didn't want to play them. You didn't want to play Colorado, and that's kind of what happened. You were in the driver's seat to play Calgary, which for some might have been a better matchup, but you were in the driver's seat to play them for the whole last end of the year. But you didn't get a lot of production out of a lot of some of those young players. And moving forward, if John Hines wants to be the coach of the Nashville Predators for more than just where his contract is right now, and if the Preds want to see themselves playing at this time next year in the second round of the NHL playoffs or the Stanley Cup playoffs, that's a fine. But in the second round of the Stanley Cup playoffs, you're going to need more out of those guys because in the playoff series, you didn't get a goal from Philip Forsberg till game four. Matt Duchene played great. Matt Duchene lit it up in that as much as you can light it up in a sweep. But he played really well in that playoff series. But you didn't get what you got out of Philip Forsberg in the regular season. And I know complimenting Cale Makar can be dangerous in this media market, but the Preds didn't have the best defenseman on the ice in that series. Cale Makar outplayed Roman Josi, whether it was Josi trying to do too much or whether it was just him not playing his best, I'll leave that part up to you. But the fact of the matter is, Cale Makar skated circles around the entire Predators team and got more production in that defenseman matchup. So, if you're not getting some of those production that you got from the regular season from those veterans, you're going to be asking for that production from the young guys. You didn't get enough for it to make you feel great about the direction moving forward. But that's where John Hines steps in. That's where this season, you need more out of those guys. You need to pay attention to how those guys develop, how those players, I'll even throw Trenin in there too. Trenin did have a pretty good playoff series, but you throw Yakov Trenin in there with Tanner Janot, Phil Tomasino, Ellie Tolvanen, Luke Cunnan. You need to see those guys get better because if those guys don't get better and they don't develop, it's going to get ugly in May of 2023, a lot uglier than it is of May of 2022. But speaking of ugly, it's getting pretty ugly between Jimbo Fisher and Nick Saban. Now, I've been waiting for this. Been waiting all day to talk about this. No love lost between those two, and what we got as a result is one of the greatest press conferences in the history of college football, or should I say, since sliced bread. We'll get into that on the other side as you're listening to The Six. I'm Elijah Campbell, also taking your phone call, 615-737-1025. Calls, text, give it to me. Let's talk. 6 to 7 right here, ESPN, 1025 The Game. Oh, poor Nick Saban. Somebody else has a legal advantage, and it's too much. Can't go through a speaking engagement without letting the world know that poor Nick Saban and the poor University of Alabama are at a competitive disadvantage because we didn't buy our players. Well, I don't buy that for a second. He might not have personally bought them to get them to come to Alabama, but somebody did. I'm old enough to remember the whole bag man thing between Ole Miss and Mississippi State that's been really well reported on. And I was born at night, wasn't born last night. So I'm not going to believe that they just didn't buy anybody. Not going to buy that. But that was Nick Saban at a speaking engagement complaining about alleged disadvantages that Texas A&M has over other teams in the SEC or in college football in general because they have been dropping bags left and right, dipping into that oil money reserve to get the best recruiting class money could buy. Legally, I should say. NIL, legally. Well, Nick Saban said that, so Jimbo Fisher, obviously was going to take some exception to it. Why wouldn't you? He just got called out. He almost didn't get called a cheater, but was kind of insinuated that he was. There was some insinuation of wrongdoing here. So, like Jimbo Fisher likes to do, he responded. And here's how the start of that response went.
First of all, I'll say it's a shame that we have to do this. It's really despicable. It's despicable that somebody can say things about somebody and an organ. More importantly, 17-year-old kids. You're taking shots at 17-year-old kids and their families. And they broke state laws. That they're all money. We bought every player on this group. We never bought anybody. No rules were broken. Nothing was done wrong. It was all in the, and the way we do things, the ethics in which we do things, and these families, it's despicable that a reputable head coach could come out and say this when he doesn't get his way or things don't go his way. The narcissist in him doesn't allow those things to happen, and it's ridiculous. But when he's not on top, and the parity in college football he's been talking about, go talk to coaches who coach for him. You'll find out all the parity. Go dig into wherever he's been. You can find out anything. And it's a shame that you got to sit here and defend 17-year-old kids and families and Texas A&M because we do things right. We're always going to do things right. But we're always going to be here.
Ah, I like it. One of my favorite plays in the book. I will respond to your vague allegations of cheating and wrongdoing, and I will eviscerate you by insinuating that you have been cheating for a very long time. Because as we know, most college football coaches have done some shady stuff to get the players that they really, really wanted that they didn't think they had a chance at. But you thought he was done right there? You were sorely mistaken.
We're doing a heck of a job. These coaches have done a great job. Our players have done a great job. The whole organization of recruiting people. It's despicable that we got to sit here at this level of ball and say these things to defend the people of this organization, the kids, 17-year-old kids, and their families. It's amazing. Some people think they're God. Go dig into how God did his deal. You may find out about a guy that a lot of things you don't want to know. We built him up to be the czar of football. Go dig into his past or anybody that's ever coached with him. You can find out anything you want to find out, what he does and how he does it. And it's despicable. It really is. And it's a shame we have to sit up here and have this conversation about things we do. And it's personal to us? Yes, it is. It's personal to A&M. It's personal to our players. It's personal to our coaches and everybody involved. And I know the guy. Know him really well. It's amazing that we're allowed to do those things. It's really despicable. And I hate it. For our players who are coming here, who did things the right way, have done things the right way, and will continue to do things the right way, I apologize to you that people insult you publicly the way they're doing it. And our fans, I apologize to you guys for people saying those things about Texas A&M. But promise you this, there are no violations. There are nothing wrong. It's the second time we've had to do this with grown men who don't get their way and want to pout, throw a fit, and act up. Just go ask all the people who work for him. You'll know exactly what he's about. I always said this. My dad always told me this. When people show you who they are, believe them. He's showing you who he is.
Amazing. Amazing. And that's just his opening statement. That's before he took any questions. And first things first, when I think about that, A, the sentence, go dig in how God made his deal. I find that to be one of the funniest parts of that, because that sentence by itself is really puzzling. And all you do is make you want to ask for more context. But my God, the closest thing to Nas's ether in a college football press conference was what you just heard. And of course, Nick Saban knew whenever he said what he said, it was going to get national attention, because almost everything Nick Saban says get national attention, no matter what it is he's complaining about. So of course he's going to try to call Jimbo and clear the air. But do you think Jimbo took that call? Absolutely bleeping not.
Questions? To the left, Olin.
A couple of things, Jimbo. First of all, have you had any contact with Nick since?
No. Oh, he's called.
You just didn't take the call?
Not going to. We're done.
And
he shows you who he is.
And then I just wanted to.
He's the greatest ever, huh?
And then I just wanted
when
to.
You got all the advantages?
Huh?
It's easy.
And I just wanted to. Just put it point blank. So, no players, and you're saying that no players in
there's
this
no laws of anything we ever promised, done anything that goes against the laws of the state of Texas, and it's insulting to say a 17-year-old and his family broke laws. No,
it's amazing how the reporter has to like fight to get his question in, because Jimbo's not done with the pot shots at all. Absolutely not. It's like my favorite part of this press conference was that nobody could get a question in, because anytime Jimbo got done talking, he was like, no, I'm not done. I have more that I want to absolutely unload upon on Nick Saban. It continues here.
Down front, Brent.
You know, y'all had both spoken so highly of each other in the past in terms of what y'all have done in your previous relationship. So how disappointing was it to hear that from him, you know, in terms of, you know, a mentor type to you.
It's disappointing.
Well.
No, it wasn't. Now, listen, you coach with people like Bobby Bowden and learn how to do things. You coach with other people and learn how not to do things. There's a reason people don't go, I ain't went back and worked for him with opportunities.
Coach back behind
don't
the lights.
Be associated with it.
How they go about it and
no,
so
I'm not.
Forth.
Okay.
So
not
you have no
in
knowledge of any of
they have collectives. I know there's a collective here. I don't know who's got what, when's got what. Had no idea last year. That is not what we do or what we're about.
I was going to say, that's by design. You saying, hey, I'm staying out of this.
Yeah, I mean, I have no sponsorships in those things. And that's the truth. Well, listen, I'm going to tell you one thing. You can call me anything you want to call me. You ain't calling me a cheat. I don't cheat and I don't lie. So I learned that when I was a kid. If you did, the old man slapped you side of the head. Maybe somebody should have slapped him.
Saying someone should have slapped Nick Saban is... That's a hell of a way to get your press conference going. And there's more and more and more to get into with that press conference. But the scorched earth tactic Jimbo Fisher had to confront Nick Saban is something we don't see very often. And it is quite the juicy development in college football. And my favorite part about this is I know Jimbo Fisher isn't the cleanest of head coaches either. He alluded to his time working with Bobby Bowden. I did the right things under Bobby Bowden. But Steve Spurrier used to always call FSU Free Shoes University for a reason. These coaches know what they do. Who are you kidding? Jimbo Fisher here trying to act like a saint might be the funniest part of all of this. Not just the insults, not just saying Nick Saban should be slapped, but the fact that he is pleading complete and total ignorance to any wrongdoing of his own. I'm sure there was some shady stuff with the recruitment of Jameis Winston. Free Shoes University. It's not all innocent because college football coaching isn't. In college athletics, whether it be college football or college basketball had their own FBI investigation. There are guys in federal prison right now because of how badly they hampered with the recruiting process. Don't tell me that there's absolutely no wrongdoing whatsoever. But the reason no one's going to attack him on it is because no one cares anymore because all of this stuff is legal. We have Grant on our phone line, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com, wanting to weigh in on this Jimbo Fisher and Nick Saban feud. Grant, what's up, man?
Hey, Elijah. So, big fan of the show. Real quick, just a couple
thank you.
Of points. I don't know if Nick Saban, you know, he talks about, you know, the players getting bought and everything. Does he realize that he actually told reporters and analysts that Bryce Young, before taking a snap and eventually becoming the Heisman Trophy winner, Bryce Young got a seven-figure NIL deal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he remembers that, but Bryce Young did it. He didn't have an issue with it. I think, honestly, Greg Sankey, the commissioner, I think he's commissioner of the SEC, he gave a public reprimand to both Jimbo and Nick Saban. I really don't think that was necessary. I mean, it's just a slap on the wrist, like, what are you going to do? I really don't think that was necessary. And honestly, I've always been a big fan of Jimbo Fisher, and I'll end on this. But listening to him just lay into Nick Saban, who I've always had respect for, I don't like it. Alabama wins all the time, it seems like. And if they don't win, they're always around the title. But I've always had great respect for Nick Saban and what he does and how he does things. But after this right here, I mean, honestly, it's just like, dude, you realize that your players can use NIL. It's not like Alabama is, you know, excluded from that. I'm sure you've used it too. Bryce Young, I mean, he got a seven-figure deal. And so, and I also thought, I'll end on this one right here. He also, I don't know if you noticed, he took a swipe at Deion Sanders' team, Jacksonville State.
I did notice that.
With Travis Hunter. Saying that to Travis Hunter reportedly signed a $1 million deal. And, of course, Deion Sanders said he absolutely positively refuted that, saying that he's not – nothing like that happened, which I don't think – I wouldn't disagree with Deion. So I'll hang up. I'll let you respond to what I just said. Again, love the show. Love everything you guys do. Have a great rest of your day.
Awesome. Thank you for your phone call, Grant. Appreciate that, man. And you know, there's a lot of truth to what you said, too, because Nick Saban was the guy who revealed that Bryce Young was making seven figures in an NIL deal before taking his first snap as the starter at the University of Alabama. He did that. That was him. He is benefiting from the system that he is supposedly ripping. And that also kind of brings me to this. I do have a little bit of a sub-theory about as to why he is calling out Texas A&M and why he is saying certain things, even though he is dead wrong. He knows he's dead wrong, and he knows exactly the type of response. He knows pinheads like me are going to be complaining about it on the radio. He knows people are going to be talking about hypocrisy. But there's one thing that makes me think that even though he knows the backlash he's going to receive and the headache it might cause, it might actually be worth it for him. I'll tell you what that is on the other side as you listen to The Six with Elijah Campbell here on ESPN. 102.5 The Game, 106.3 in The Game Nashville app. Final segment here on The Six, ESPN 102.5 The Game. It's your boy Elijah Campbell taking you through up to 7 o'clock where our coverage of Game 2 between the Dallas Mavericks and the Golden State Warriors will tip off then. You can hear a lot of these awesome playoff games here. And I'll get into that too. I'll preview that game because the Warriors are doing something in terms of making a run like they have in a way that you have not seen them do it before. But we're still talking Jimbo Fisher, Nick Saban, the nuclear college football feud of the century. We got a text on our text line driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com, and this is from Micah in Goodlettsville. He says, "Jimbo, me thinkest thou protest too much." And you know what? As funny as the whole press conference is, and as much as I agree with a lot of the stuff he's saying, and as much as I love someone standing up to Nick Saban and not being afraid to tick him off because they play each other every year, I kind of agree with Micah a little bit. Because Jimbo Fisher's not completely clean here either. We can speculate about things. I don't have any proof that there are recruiting violations. But I go back to the Steve Spurrier line. FSU, Free Shoes University. And if Nick Saban has all of these, I don't know, quote, which as Jimbo Fisher referred to him as God, if you look into quote-unquote God's past and we see things that might taint our version of quote-unquote God, then Jimbo Fisher probably took something from that. Chad Withrow on Stillman & Company with Caroline Fenton, and of course today it was Chase McCabe as well, mentioned that Jerry Pruitt got in trouble. His first head coaching gig in college football at a university like Tennessee got fired because of recruiting violations right off the bat. Do you think he just did that on his own, or do you think he saw somebody do that? He coached under Nick Saban for a while, was his defensive coordinator. Do you think he learned it from the best, but just couldn't get away with it? Just because you learn from the best doesn't mean you can replicate the best. And I think Jeremy Pruitt learned that lesson the hard way, and the University of Tennessee learned that lesson the hard way whenever he went to coach and got fired because A, the team wasn't very good, and B, because there were recruiting violations, hilariously documented by the Dan Patrick Show, that alleged that they might have been cash used in McDonald's bags. Who can forget, right? And of course, like with all these college football coaches, like they're all guilty. Almost all of them are. I'd be surprised to be able to see a college football head coach who doesn't indulge in some recruiting violation, especially when you're one of these schools like Alabama or Texas A&M, or USC, that gets these massive recruiting classes every year, especially in a place like Alabama. I know Alabama's got the football history even before Nick Saban got there. He's like, what, 7-6 his first year there? And then the next year he gets the number one recruiting class in the country and really rarely relinquished that spot in recruiting rankings until this year. But I was talking about earlier in the last segment, there might be one reason as to why Nick Saban said this. Not because he truly believes that there's this major injustice done against him and the University of Alabama. Poor University of Alabama. But I think he wants donors to step it up. Now listen, now hear me out here. He says that complaining about Texas A&M buying all their players. Maybe it's not just belly aching over some perceived injustice. Maybe that is a back-channel way of communicating with boosters who have a lot of money to step their game up, to do the New England Patriots mantra of do your job. Nick Saban's here saying, I'm doing my job by getting the kids interested. I'm doing my job by finding these kids. I'm doing my job by winning the games on the football field, bringing in national championships, winning SEC championships on a year-by-year basis. If you're a booster and you have any chance to create an NIL collective, or you have an avenue to do so, how about you do your job and fork up the money that they are at Texas A&M, because Nick Saban is the ultimate competitor. He's the greatest football coach in the history of college football for a reason. It's not because he's not competitive. It's not because he will sit aside while everybody else gets an edge or an advantage on him. He knows where the advantage lies in college football in the year of our Lord 2022, and that advantage comes through NIL and instant transfers. He's already working on the instant transfer thing. Trust me, Alabama's brought in some key transfers for next year. But now you got to get into the NIL game. He already mentioned that they're trying because we all know that Bryce Young got seven figures before he took a snap as the starter at Alabama because he told us that. He volunteered that information and still said what he said publicly. Now, part of me likes to think it's just him complaining about this perceived injustice done in college football. But the college football Illuminati conspiracy theorist in me believes he is saying this because he wasn't talking to that crowd at that fundraiser or whatever the hell it was. He's talking to people that have control over NIL collectives and say, listen, I'm doing my job and you should do yours. Realistically, I think that might be what this is all about. This might not be just an accusation tossing contest between Jimbo Fisher and Nick Saban, because if recruiting violations were, I guess, were bodies in their houses, might both look like John Wayne Gacy. But at the end of the day, they know what's going to win them college football games. NIL, instant transfers. And Alabama's not dominating the NIL game. So maybe that's why Nick Saban said what he said. But tonight, we do have Golden State Warriors, Dallas Mavericks, game two of the Western Conference Final coming up here next on 102.5 The Game. And I alluded to it earlier, this Golden State Warriors team just ran through Dallas in game one. They can win this whole thing. Obviously, you have Steph Curry, you have Klay Thompson. The pair has won three NBA titles between the two of them, but how have they done it? They do it by being the best shooting backcourt in the history of the NBA. But this year, it's different. This year, when I watched them play against Dallas, I didn't see this barrage of three-pointers being made. I didn't see the 2015-16 offensive attack. But what I saw was a defensive clinic. Now, combined, Steph Curry and Klay Thompson, they were a combined 4 of 13 from three-point range. That's not their best. Steph was 3-9. Steph Curry's had a three-point regression this year. As good as he's been, he had a three-point regression this year. Klay Thompson, the playoffs, if you take out that Game 6 against Memphis, where he almost single-handedly closed them out, Game 6 Klay in classic fashion, didn't have a great shooting series. The Game 2 they lost in Memphis, he shot 2-12. He threw up 10 bricks from beyond the three-point line. This isn't the best offensive Golden State team that they've ever had. They were 17th in the NBA in the regular season in offensive rating. In terms of efficiency, they're league average, but they are elite on the defensive side of the ball. I know Boston has been great defensively all year. They're number two in defensive rating, might I add. And even the playoffs, their length and their size has been an absolute problem on every team they've played. But this Golden State Warriors team made Luka Doncic look average in the first game. Doncic was 6-for-18. And the philosophy of, if Doncic is getting in the paint, he is going to see bodies. He is going to see Draymond Green. He is going to see Kevon Looney. He is going to get roughed up. The Warriors already do the best job of any team in the NBA on communicating on defense. Say what you want about Draymond Green. He's not a fan favorite. The only people that really love Draymond Green are Warriors fans, Draymond Green's family, and maybe Michigan State alum. But he's the smartest player in the NBA. Defensively, he's definitely the smartest player in the NBA. Watch them play tonight. If you're not listening to it on 102.5, 106.3, or the Game Nashville app, watch how he communicates on defense. When to switch. They're very selective with switching. Boston can just switch all screens because they're so long and they have such great size and everybody on there is a great defender. Jordan Poole's a good defender, not a great one. Klay Thompson's not a defender he used to be before a torn ACL and a popped Achilles kept him out of 2 years. He's not the defender he used to be. Steph Curry is a below-average defender, but is good at creating steals at times. Really, the only players on this team where you're like, these are lockdown guys. Gary Payton, the mitten, not the glove, but the mitten, Draymond Green. Andrew Wiggins has gotten better defensively. Otto Porter is a solid defender too, but they are a great team defense. They don't have a bunch of great individual defensive players, but they are the best team defense in the NBA. Boston has the best group of individual defenders. The Warriors have the best team defense in the NBA. There's a reason the Mavericks only scored 87 points, and that when Luka Doncic was on the floor, only scored 76 points per 100 possessions. The Mavericks did. The Mavericks' offensive rating was 76. Brutally low. Because the Warriors have a defensive game plan designed to make him have to hit tough shots. It's not going to be easy, and the Mavericks haven't particularly played great on the road at times. A lot of blowouts on the road. So, with that being said, Golden State Warriors, -6.5, feels pretty right to me. Thank you for tuning in and listening with me tonight. I'm Elijah Campbell. You've been listening to The Six on ESPN 102.5 The Game. And, of course, tomorrow, 9 to 11, Michelle Knezevic and I on Campbell Knezevic. Coming up next, Mavericks, Warriors, Game 2. You're listening to ESPN 102.5, 106.3, and The Game Nashville app.